Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marches, they never changed anything.
We'll be right back.
okay, our board here is freezing up. So let me refresh the page and see if I can straighten out things that way. Excuse me. Or use a phone in addition to the laptop. It fooled me. Okay, today's podcast is titled Wealth Without Regulation, 1609 to 1776. And we want to take some principles from common denominators and apply them to what's, you know, apply them to what we can do today. So why are we waiting on it? Let's see if we can. All right. Let's play another audio while we get back to our regular audio and get things straightened out. We don't want to play that. Well, let me get something interesting for you guys. Let's go with this one. Little entertainment from the TV show Power.
What's up, everybody? This is Jay, and this video is about, is Tariq worth $2 million? Now, we all know that he's a damn fool, and he deserves what he's getting, but is he worth $2 million? Before we do, let's hit that like button. I need to get 200 likes for this video, and if you haven't already, please subscribe and bang that bell. I'm trying to reach 20,000 subs by the end of the month. Let's get into it. Now, Tariq, we all know, is a damn fool. He doesn't listen to Ghost or Tasha, and he's been corrupted by Kanan and turned against his father by Kanan and Tasha, and now he thinks that he's a dope boy when all he is a dorm room dope boy. He doesn't know anything about real life situations, and so he tried to get over on Vincent and the Olive Garden dope boy crew, and he bought some baby aspirin and tried to pass it off as being some pills, ecstasy, or whatever the case. And no, that would not work. If anything, he would have been better off trying to cut it. But he's an idiot. He knows nothing about this. He thought because they look similar that Vincent wouldn't know anything. And yeah, maybe with the eye test he wouldn't know, but once they began to sell the merch, then people would complain saying that these were duds, that the strength was weak, it was nothing, and that ruined his business. Not necessarily put him out of business, but made him look bad, as if he was selling duds to people trying to take their money. And Tariq already got his face smashed in the ground like a puppy that pooped on the carpet in their living room. And so that wasn't enough for him to realize that these are not the people that he should be messing with. And he came back talking about he was a man of his word. And then he sold them a bag of bull crap, whereas he would have been better off telling them, hey, I don't have the weight, I wish I had it, whatever the case, but you know, I'm not able to do it, I'm out. But instead, he's trying to get money and sell stuff that's not it. And even Vincent pulled out a gun in front of his face and let him know, hey, don't mess with me. And even that wasn't a good enough warning for Tariq not to do it. He's such an idiot. And so now he's in big trouble, and they want $2 million or else they were going to kill him. And my cousin Vinny, he don't give a rat's ass or a witch's titty how Ghost and Tommy come up with the money. And Tariq, he's such an idiot. He doesn't know that now what he's done has allowed Vincent to put the squeeze like toothpaste on Ghost, Tommy, and Tasha to come up with money to save his life once again. He almost had that happen when he was with Kanan and they was going to kidnap him. And then he had Proctor killed and put Proctor's daughter in a situation where she has no parents. And he think because he took her to cousin Benny's house that he did good. He had his whole apartment where he lived ruined thanks to what he did working with Tommy. He doesn't have any idea on how to think first before he causes actions, because if he did, he wouldn't have went on ahead.
Many a young athlete.
Okay, we got things straight. Okay, today's podcast is titled Wealth Without Regulation, and we're going to start off, we want to take a look at the years 1607 to 1776, 1607 to 1776, and since we played a little bit of the guy was giving a relapse on what he called it, the TV show Power. We'll include that in the discussion. But we want to take a look at 1607 to 1776. What were the distinctions then where people were able to get uber rich, including some black folk, believe it or not, and today in 2021? What can we learn from then and apply it to today? And we're going to use TV shows and some other stuff to illustrate our points. Now, before we do that, I have a basically motivational routine that I do, which includes three audios. We done played the Claude Anderson. So now let's go to Jamarian Styles, the kid with no arms who went out for the basketball team, made the basketball team, and scored buckets.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Styles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out. He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again, this time on the near side, for another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Styles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No. Nope.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt. I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way. Your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon, which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others, because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word because, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. Man, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, and the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been and has any positive change come to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 apiece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
She a dude. She just hit you in your face. She a dude. That bitch good, nigga. Oh. Beat her motherfucking ass. She drug you, motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass.
That nigga kid. That nigga hurt himself.
You from New State.
It's over. It's over. It's over. When I say it's over, everybody get the fuck out of here.
Man, fuck it. Let's go across the street.
I ain't caught it. I'll slap the fuck out of one of them.
Look, the main spot that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you could do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yi or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns. Because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate-made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity, and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield? See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that, because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, the Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-whack movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavor Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-Civil Rights Movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them. Which is why every single year one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place, there's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087 this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is. And it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening, because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old, and I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you got to own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're going to have with most of the people around you.
And now, an exclusive first look at the upcoming documentary, 7 a.m.
Because true economic science is a branch of military science. War and money go hand in hand. Most wars are fights so people can make more money, and war is money. That means what? That the European American is not about to prepare black children to compete with his children for control of the economic sector. It's not going to happen. So if black people want this science, we got to teach it, we got to study it, and we're going to have to make some mistakes in perfecting it because we're still babies in the water of global economic commerce. As African people, we are financially illiterate. So we should not be surprised that we're so economically backward because we were never taught how to be economically forward. Our education in America has not provided or prepared us to be able to compete with Europeans economically. The historically black college was designed to do what? Teach you how to work for white people. Public schools, charter schools, parochial schools, independent schools. What is the purpose of education in America for black children right now? To teach them how to make a living working for white people. But I don't want the kids coming to my school to be going to class thinking that I'm learning this so I can go and get paid by a white person. They're going to be empowered to start their own business. When they leave that school, they're going to go into business. And why do we need our people to be self-sufficient? Because when you're not self-sufficient, you can't speak your mind. One of the biggest reasons why black people have been so cowardly in the post-civil rights movement, not standing up for ourselves, standing up for our children, standing up against police brutality, we're scared to lose our jobs. We have to work. We got kids. I can't talk about the racism on my job. I might lose it. So the reason why we're not speaking our mind is because we don't have economic freedom. As Mr. Garvey said, Marcus Garvey said, that a solid racial program must be built on a solid economic foundation. Show me your economic condition, and I'll show me your political condition. The political economy of the black community rests on the premise that because they do not make their own money, they are enslaved to Europeans. And as a result of that, they will never be able to do what needs to be done to carve out a future for their children, because the hand that pays is also the hand that rules them.
Okay, we're waiting for some, I had a, well, this audio's loading up slow, but anyway, Today's podcast is titled Wealth Without Regulation, and we're looking at the years 1607 to 1776. Now, the United States, and what I want to, matter of fact, let me throw this out there. Those years, in my opinion, were the best years, or have been the best years so far, if a person wanted to become wealthy in what we now call the United States of America. Now, from 1607 to July 3rd, 1776, there was no such thing as the United States of America. That's a major clue bomb right there. And I sort of give mainstream, well, let me relate to it this way. Hidden in plain sight in the form of, well, one of the forms of public school education or elementary school education. If you read it and study it, they really give you, drop some major clues on how to become a fortune builder or where to go to become a fortune builder. All right, now, like I said, between 1607 to 1776, July 3rd, 1776, there was no such thing as the United States. Now, they call the United States the land of, you know, opportunity and all this or that or other. Well, this is, I want to take a look at these years in 1607, because actually we can go back to 1521. But let's go with 1607. In 1607, and in the scrolling marquee, that was the first successfully established colony of Europeans in what we now call the United States, Jamestown. Okay. Now, that was 1607. Now, if we go back in the time machine, 1607, now Ponce de Leon came on. He came over with, which is now called the state of Florida within the United States. That's today. But he came over before the Jamestown people. He came over in 1521. All right. But the Native Americans handed him his ass. He got injured and later on died from his injuries. So from 1521, because that's when the Europeans, in air quotes, first attempted to colonize what we now call the United States of America via Florida. That mission was aborted. They had to retreat. And from my research so far, nothing happened for 86 years until Jamestown successfully established their colony. 86 years. Now, from, you can go back to, let's go from 1607. So from 1607 to July 3rd, 1776, essentially, what's the term we can use today? What we now call the United States, which was not the United States at the time, it was wide open to accumulate as much wealth as you wanted. There were no laws on the books as we know them today. on the federal, because there was no federal government. There were no states. You know, later on you had the 13 colonies, but you had no state law, you had no federal law, you had no local law. Now, there was de facto law, you know, the law of the jungle, but nothing written with judges and court systems and police force and all that other stuff, as we know today. There were no government agencies. And matter of fact, before I lose my thought, because I was about to say this before anyway, fundamentally speaking, everything you need to know, your third to maybe fifth grade. Anyway, your third to fifth grade history teacher laid out the fundamentals. They didn't break it down, but they gave you some key figures, enough to study. If you get in depth of how, with the Pilgrims, Ponce de Leon, how did these people build fortunes, create a whole lot of wealth? And some people might jump off and say, well, they had slaves. Many did, but then a lot more didn't. But the common denominator that I found in my research is, and this, that's what I'm calling this is in plain sight, from 1607 to 1776, there was no state law, there was no federal law, and there was no local law or ordinances as we know them today. Because what we had today is, like, for instance, Securities Exchange Commission. You know, a lot of these government agencies basically are like in a monopoly game. They're the police force, or they're the enforcement that basically puts the brakes on you creating wealth or trying to build wealth in a particular area. I'll give an example. The late Joseph Kennedy, patriarch of the Kennedy political family, he got rich. One of the ways he got rich, well, hell, he was a bootlegger, what we would call a bootlegger today. He got wealthy that way, and he also got wealthy with stocks. He also helped put together the SEC, Securities Exchange Commission. So one of the ways that he got wealthy, which when he did it, insider trading was legal. There were no government agencies in place to prevent that. But he and others helped form a government agency. So insider trading, hey, Martha Stewart went to prison behind it. But when he first did it, there was no government agency to do that. So what you have between 1607 and July 3rd, 1776, is very little or no, well, actually zero government regulation. Now, we can go from, and you also had Africans that came over here that were not enslaved and got wealthy too. Now, there was one black person, or what we would identify as black these days, Anthony Johnson, and that's his Anglo name, Anthony Johnson, who came over here as an indentured servant from, I think, what we would call Ghana today, or even Angola, I think Ghana, one of the two. After he served up his contract as an indentured servant, Anthony Johnson became a plantation owner, and he owned slaves. This was all during colonial times. Matter of fact, let me look up the years of his when he was living, Anthony Johnson. And I'm putting all this information out here today because essentially, all right, Anthony Johnson, his profession was farmer. All right. He was born in 1600 in Angola, and he transitioned. His sunset was 1670 in the colony of Virginia, still not the United States of America. And there were other people like Anthony Johnson. Matter of fact, let me read some more about Anthony Johnson. Anthony Johnson, born 1600, sunset was 1670. And once again, we're looking at the years 1607 to 1776 because we want to leapfrog it to what you had to do in 2021 and beyond in the Western Hemisphere to get wealthy. All right, Anthony Johnson was a black Angolan known for achieving, and see, back then, the term black wasn't used to identify people, but then that's a whole other podcast. Anyway, was Angolan known for achieving wealth in the early 17th century colony of Virginia? Now, once again, it was the colony of Virginia, not the state of Virginia, and there was no United States of America. All right, so we're talking about, all right, there was zero state regulation. There was zero federal regulation because those two entities did not exist for him at that time. Now, he was one of the first African-American property owners and had his right to legally own a slave recognized by the Virginia courts. Held as an indentured servant in 1621, he earned his freedom after several years and was granted land by the colony. His occupation was a farmer. All right. He later became a tobacco farmer in Maryland. He attained great wealth after completing his term as an indentured servant, as referred to as the Black Patriarch of the first community of Negro property owners of America. And if you go on, the internet, there's a portrait of Anthony Johnson. Now, what I'm saying is this. This is why I'm picking out 1607 and 1776. In 2021, which we're in right now, March, and beyond, if you want to get wealthy in the United States, matter of fact, I'm going to say the whole Western Hemisphere or anywhere around the globe, you need to model Anthony Johnson, take some distinctions of him, and the signers of the Constitution. There are others, but I'm just picking out high-profile examples. Now, number one, what Anthony Johnson was able to do then, you can't do everything he did then, now, in what we now call the United States of America. Once again, he wasn't regulated. He wasn't regulated by a state government because it didn't exist. He wasn't regulated by a federal government because it didn't exist. He didn't have these agencies, you know, because now you got, what we have, the Department of Agriculture. That's a regulatory agency. You know, you got local politicians, state politicians, and federal politicians, legislators, that what they do is they design laws that regulate you. Now, what can, now taking, and not only him, because he was black. Not what I read to you, Wikipedia said it, not me. It's a historical fact that he gained a lot of great wealth in what we now call the United States. That can be done today. But let's model what Anthony Johnson did, as well as the framers of the Constitution, prior to them signing it. How did they do it before July 4th, 1776? Because their parallels are same like Anthony Johnson. And not use the term slave labor and replace it with cheap labor. But here's what you can do right now and what in the Western Hemisphere globally, but let's just look at the United States. Number one, we got some barriers in our, right here on the landscape. In the 50 states, you can practically do the same thing if you model as close as possible to some of the finer distinctions of Anthony Johnson and the framers of the Constitution and others, but those are the high-profile examples. Number one, for or select a profession or craft that has little or no government regulation. I'm going to say that's number one, but anything I'm saying right now is in no particular order. Prime example. Mark Zuckerberg. I don't even know if he's 30 yet. Bill Gates. Wozniak and the late Steve Jobs. How did these jokers become billionaires? Multi-billionaires before 30. Facebook is nothing more than a glorified website. Anybody within the sound of my voice at this time in history, which is March 18th, 2021, can start a website. You don't need a license to do that. Anybody, you don't have to speak English. You can speak any language that you want to. You can be from Pluto. You can be from the next galaxy. You don't need a business license to start a website. There's zero regulation. People, and that's what Facebook is. Cyberspace, as of right now, governments around the world have not figured out how to regulate cyberspace. And they're going to be other people, just like Zuckerberg. Matter of fact, there are people in cyberspace right now that legally are earning six figure incomes on a monthly basis. You can go on eBay. You can go on Facebook, YouTube, Patreon. Google's got different platforms. No business license required. Nobody's going to jail. Cyberspace is the catch that started, Airbnb. Now, vacation rentals are nothing new. They have been around for decades before the two or three guys who started Airbnb were around. And Airbnb started out with two guys that were facing eviction. They weren't trying to make $1 billion. Long story short, because Airbnb, now they're billionaires. They're not even 40 yet. They're like 36, 38, 39 at the most in age, not even 40 yet. But Airbnb is an app. No governments, to my knowledge, around the world have figured out how to regulate an app. So the founders of Airbnb just did an updated version or innovation of what Anthony Johnson and the framers of the Constitution did. The common denominator between time and space, between 1607 and 2021, is they got into something that had little or zero government regulation. You don't need a business license to get an app done. You don't need a business to have a website. Wozniak and, Jobs. Apple computers or Apple products, iPhone, the iPad, the MacBook, et cetera, et cetera. It's a private label. Anybody within the sound of my voice can contact a company that will actually manufacture the computer or electronic that you want to have or sell. Wozniak essentially was the one that put together the specs for the early Apple products. Steve Jobs was the salesman. Apple computers, and let me use the analogy of sizzling steak. Because what sells a steak is not the steak. What sells the steak is the smell of the sizzle. Wozniak is Apple computers. Steve Jobs was the sizzle that sold the electronics. Now, Wozniak put together some specs. And then, once again, let's look at what was happening between 1607 to 1776. Once again, everything that you basically need to know to get fabulously rich is taught in small schools by the time you're in sixth grade. As you hear about the George Washington, you hear about the framers of the Constitution and all this, I'm just, you got to go deeper and then compare what they did then and then now. So what Jobs and Wozniak did was, okay, slavery, or once again, let's replace that term with cheap labor. They went to countries that have cheap labor. Anybody within the sound of my voice can contact a manufacturer of phones or various electronics, clothing items, and give them your specs, and they'll manufacture it just the way you want it. And then it'll be with your brand on it. It's called private labeling. And it's everywhere. It's in the grocery stores. Like when you go in a grocery store, like let's say you're going to Whole Foods. You're going to Whole Foods and you want to buy some Raisin Bran or Frosted Flakes. Okay. Well, Raisin Bran is a private label because in Whole Foods, they might have their own version private label brand called Whole Foods Raisin Bran. Same company could be producing the same damn cereal is in both boxes. but different private labels. Private, you don't need a business license to come up with a private label. Now, to operate an office in various parts of the United States or the world, you might need one. But, like I said, Apple Computers is a private label. They have those electronics made in economies where there is cheap or reasonable price labor, because American labor is expensive. Same thing that Anthony Johnson did. We can look at Nike, the Just Do It people, same thing. Nike is a private label. Those basketballs, those jerseys, those sweatsuits, those baseball hats, those socks, those shoes are all made in locations where it's less expensive when it comes to labor cost and material cost. Walmart. Anybody read the book by Sam Walton, Made in America? Walmart is a private label within a private label. And what's interesting about the book Made in America, I didn't see nothing about where he made, where those products were made up. Some of the Walmart products are made in Bangladesh. In Bangladesh, the labor's, you know, very reasonable. It's affordable. So between the years of 1607 to 1776, what I'm saying is this. You can replicate what they did then, now, but you had to look at, you need to pick, number one, an emerging market, number two, an emerging industry, something that has little or zero government regulation. Uber and Lyft, zero regulation. Regulators have been trying to regulate them, but the closest they've been able to do is they've come after their local contractors. But the apps themselves, zero regulation. We're going to play a clip that we played on here before of what they're doing over in China with coffee pots and different things, which can be replicated over here as well. But we have to put it in proper context.
What's it like to live where you work? For most of us, that's unthinkable. But imagine living and working at one of the biggest factories in the world. A workplace the size of Monaco. For these 17,000 employees, it's reality. They come from all over China, seeking a brighter future at this factory called Yupa. Workers craft coffee makers, irons, and electric grills in staggering quantities every single day. But Yupa is more than a steady paycheck. It's home. People get married here. They send their kids to school here. But the work never stops. Yupa's managers are on a mission to produce new products for every corner of the globe that could forever change the way we think of made in China. Step behind the closed doors of modern China into a factory the size of a city.
Thank you.
Welcome to the place that calls itself Factory of the World. By the time you finish watching this program, Yupa's 17,000 Chinese workers will produce nearly 20,000 electrical appliances. Every day they churn out 60,000 irons. Every month, Yupa makes 36,000 coffee makers. That's two new machines for every Starbucks on the planet. And every year, these laborers produce a staggering 18 million electric grills. Stacked side by side, they'd span the Atlantic from New York to London. Chances are you own something built right here. Factories like these don't exist in North America or Europe, but they're not uncommon in China, where labor is cheap. Yupa runs on human sweat alone. No need for robots. To ensure non-stop production, workers need a steady stream of parts. Someone has to make sure those parts get to the right place in time. This is Ming Long Pa. He started work at Yupa in 1994.
I'm in charge of production control. Production control is the brain of the factory. Its main function is to coordinate each department.
If any of Yupa's factories run out of parts, Mr. He's job is on the line.
The production line cannot wait. We have to guarantee that our production is smooth. Running out of materials would affect our efficiency, affect our productivity, and affect our revenue. So I have to fix this in the shortest time possible.
Today, a problem at the iron factory needs smoothing out. Workers on the iron line are low on a crucial part. To keep up production, they need 2,000 units, and they need them now.
Just now I found out the main problems here at the iron department. One major problem is the case for model 603. They need 2,000 right now.
Traditional plants use outside suppliers for their components, not Yupa. To slash costs and stay competitive, Yupa builds its own parts on site. So Mr. He's supplier is only a bike ride away. But even the supplier is dangerously low on stock. Mr. He has found barely enough parts to last the day. When he gets another urgent call. Now the grill factory is low on a crucial component. Grills are the company's most profitable products. Yupa started producing one line of grills in 1994. Now, 60 assembly lines churn out 800 different models. Workers make one grill every 12 seconds. That's 50,000 grills per day, or 1.5 million per month. Enough grills for every person in Dallas. Grills bring in $350 million a year, but Yupa wants more. Little wonder Liu Jinye acts like a general leading his troops to war. By next year, managers expect workers to crank out $500 million worth of grills. Yupa's profits have to rise to outmuscle the competition. Mr. Ye supervises 850 workers on 30 lines.
We have to coordinate all these workers and pull all their thoughts into one. It takes teamwork to accomplish our goals, to get the results we want.
Mr. Ye is obsessed with quality control. His aim? Boost output without compromising quality. In a factory this big, with a production run so massive, even the hyper-efficient Mr. Ye hits a roadblock.
This holder piece holds the grill plate. What we're seeing now is the assembly of this piece. The problem is the size. It's the wrong size.
They've run out of part number 2627. It attaches the core heating element to the frame. Without this simple component, assembly lines will shut down. Unless Mr. Ha finds a fresh supply. And soon.
If we don't get them the parts, 6 production lines will have to stop.
When every part is on hand, grills assemble like a simple puzzle. Wires are linked to the heating element, and the element is fixed to the plate.
When it's not locked down properly, it will fall off. If it falls off, it will burn the hands of our customers and consumers. This job is very important.
Then it's time to connect the power cord.
The brown wire is live and the green wire is neutral. The one with the writing on it matches the brown wire. Connect them and that makes the wire live.
Each grill is inspected for flaws in construction or appearance. Finally, every grill is tested to make sure everything is in working order. On a typical day, Mr. Ye's team must make 700 of Yupa's 50,000 grills. Missing parts cause delays, cost Yupa a fortune, and force workers into overtime to meet their quota. Finding the missing parts falls to Mr. Ha, and the pressure is on. Mr. He finally arrives, and he has good news. He's found 2,000 parts to keep the lines moving, and 50,000 more are on the way. Mr. He's day has ended on a high note. He heads home to a company-subsidized apartment only minutes away. His wife, Hong Zhang-Yu, also works for the plant. Together, they lead a life of relative luxury. Family life in China is a communal affair. His parents and his in-laws live here, thanks to Yupa. It's one more reason workers are fiercely loyal to their company.
Our products all have the Made in China tag. I hope our products can bring to consumers a sense of joy, a sense of it's worth it. This is my biggest wish.
Fulfilling that wish will come at a cost.
When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Yupa's next generation of workers must leave their families behind and devote their lives to the company. It's a place tourists never see. The new face of modern China. Competitive, hungry for profits, and ready to take on the world. Located near the city of Xiaomeng, the Yupa complex sprawls for 1.8 square kilometers, almost the size of Monaco.
We have about over 20 buildings here. You know, the largest building, you know, equal like 4 football fields. You can have 60 to 70 assembly lines. Each assembly line can have 25 to 35 workers in the line.
25 years ago, there were no factories here, only farms. In the 1980s, the Chinese government decided capitalism wasn't so bad after all. The communist regime established so-called special economic zones, designated places for free markets and foreign investments. Yupa, a Taiwanese company, moved here in 1988. In a few short years, it became the largest manufacturer of irons, electric grills, and espresso makers in the world. Yupa is a city unto itself, with restaurants and convenience stores, soccer fields and basketball courts, and living quarters for everyone from students to families. Success made it big, and size keeps it successful. Mass production runs push down costs. Almost all parts are made on-site, keeping supply costs low and parts within easy reach.
Because we are in this location pretty much isolated, we don't have satellite suppliers around us to build, you know, parts for us. So we had to do it in-house, and we had to do it in a large scale.
Yupa's main advantage is a cheap and endless labor force, ready to work for a fraction of a Western wage. 16-year-old Mao Fen Guo left her family and came here in 2008. But Guo isn't just looking for work. She's here to escape poverty and make her mother proud. In China, many parents prefer sons to daughters.
My mother has only two daughters. She's always upset about that. And in order to not let her down, I must work harder and harder.
Guo is a worker in training. With about 1,000 other students, she attends Yupa's on-site trade school. To get here, she had to pass entry exams and pay Yupa tuition. Now she's enrolled in 3 years of study and hands-on training at the factory. If she does well, Guo hopes for a job at Yupa.
At the very beginning, I thought it was very hard. But now that I've gone through all this, it's easier. There's a lot to learn, but I'm still full of confidence.
Today, she and her classmates are learning everything they ever wanted to know and more about irons.
Making irons. Practically zero regulation. Today's podcast is titled Wealth Without Regulation. We're looking at the years 1607 to 1776, particularly July 3rd, 1776. We're looking at what people did, the common denominators to build wealth then, and what can we do today to mirror that in 2021 and beyond. Now, as earlier I stated, that the common denominator, and I use Anthony Johnson, who was a black man, all right, he was an indentured servant and became very wealthy. Not only a landowner, plantation owner, which is basically a farm for commercial use, and he owned slaves. But let's replace that word slaves, because the way they were looking at it is cheap labor. So today in 2021, the same wealth can be done the same thing, but we have to take a look at, all right, what did Anthony Johnson do? And I'm using him because he's black. I want to wipe out the victim whole mode. The thing that was holding a lot of people back from gaining wealth after 1776, after July 4th, 1776, has been progressively government. State government, local government, federal government. I'll give you a good example. Another, look, once again, Zuckerberg, Jobs, Wozniak with Apple, the guy who started Nike, Bill Gates. It was zero regulation or almost zero regulation. Now, of course, once you go public, you're regulated. But these guys became billionaires because they were in emerging markets that had little or zero regulation. That's how they were able to accumulate such massive amounts of wealth in a short period of time. The same thing can be applied to everybody, but you have to look at, okay, identify an emerging market. And one of the ways to do that is if you're a hobbyist or you follow hobbyists. Because there's basically hobbyists, you know, zero regulation, government regulation. Now, I want to give out some other examples, modern day examples. Okay, what can you do? Because once again, it like I said, when Anthony Johnson was doing this thing, all right, he didn't have to worry about, there was no such thing as HUD, which is a federal housing agency here in the United States. There was no local housing authority on the state level. There was no local housing authority on the local level where he was. There was zero government regulation. That's how he, as a former indentured slave during colonial times, got very wealthy. Now, your third grade history teacher won't tell you that, but that's okay. I'm telling you. Now, let's bring this up to, you know, or you might be saying, well, that's well and good for back then, all right, because we need to study how they got fabulously wealthy back then. How can we replicate what they did then now in 2021 and beyond? Well, let me play this example, and then we'll come back.
This is the Rumor Report with Angela Yee. Rumor has it. On the Breakfast Club.
So listen up.
Well, according to reports, because you know it's about their time when people are submitting their numbers to Forbes, Kanye is worth more than $6 billion. I believe
Wow.
they have the number at $6.6 billion. Now, Bloomberg reports the collaboration between Yeezy and Gap is expected to arrive in stores later this year, and that could be valued as high as $970 million. Yeezy is currently valued at $3.2 billion to $4.7 billion. Now, I have these official numbers that were submitted. And I'm going to tell you what these assets are, and the valuation of Yeezy for Adidas is $3.7 billion. The valuation of Gap Yeezy is $1.6 billion. The valuation of YeezySupply.com is $1.5 billion. He has $123 million in cash and stocks, $100 million in Skims investment, $68 million in buildings and improvements, $48 million worth of land, $10 million worth of artwork, $7 million worth of jewelry, $5 million in cars, $3 million in machinery and equipment, and $1.1 million worth of livestock, which includes sheep, horses, etc.
Okay.
Yeah, his ranch is amazing. Listen, LLC Twitter, do you realize why partnerships are important now? Does Kanye get to that $6 billion net worth without receiving a royalty around 15% of Yeezy revenue from Adidas? He got equity and royalties in his Gap partnership as well. But to LLC Twitter and everyone who got their business degrees from YouTube University, this is why partnerships are important. This is how you get your company to scale fast and get the kind of capital that Kanye currently has, but keep being happy owning 100% of nothing.
So he has his evaluation at $7.16 billion. Now, despite partnering with Adidas for the Yeezy brand, Kanye does retain complete ownership and control. He signed a 10-year agreement to design and sell clothes under the Yeezy Gap label last year, although the deal does exclude footwear, and the current Yeezy partnership that he has with Adidas lasts until 2026.
Hey, man, you know, keep growing your companies to scale.
Absolutely.
You know, keep growing that capital to make all those investments. All those investments you named from the livestock and everything else, that's because he's got the capital to do it, because he's using that capital from these partnerships that he's doing. But keep being happy owning 100% of nothing.
Stop
y'all.
It. Now, you know, when people talk all this, I got 100%. 100% of nothing
100%
is nothing.
100% of nothing is nothing.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, it's also good to be diverse, too. And you see he has a wide,
very
portfolio.
But that's what it takes
artwork, jewelry, cars, sheep, horses, land,
yeah,
buildings,
But that's what you can do. Mm-hmm. And you act like, as Envy was just saying, you get 15% of this over here, 20% of this over here, and you use that capital to make those investments and diversify your portfolio.
All right, now good news for Boosie. He is officially cancer-free. If you guys remember, he was asking his fans to pray for him when he went to his annual checkup.
Annual cancer checkup. I come every year. Y'all say a prayer for me. I already said 100 prayers. I'm still going to be cancer-free. My fans, family, y'all say a prayer for me.
I love it.
Then a few hours later, he posted, "I'm cancer-free. Tears of joy. Thanks to everybody who said a prayer for me. God is great."
I love it. Black people building capital. Black people beating cancer. I love it. Give me one more, ye. Come on. Give us something good.
All right. Let me skip that one.
No, what was it? What was it?
DJ Drama was on Drink Champs.
Okay.
And it got a little awkward. Nori basically put out this teaser, and here is, according to Nori, it seems like he's giving some motives, I guess, into this Drake and Drama situation. Listen to this.
Drake smashed your girl.
Jesus.
Well, which other way I'm supposed to say it?
Drake has sexual relations
with a girl that was affiliated with you. All of a sudden, Meek, Philadelphia artist, winds up in Mean Street Studio, and he hears this reference of these other songs, discrepancies. What's my man's name? He ain't been around since.
Quentin Miller.
Now, all roads led to DJ Drama at that time. I can't wait till that full story gets told one day.
You know, we asked him about that when Drake threw in the line. Remember when he was up there, and I was
when,
like,
when drama said last summer I had drama girl, not right now. Yeah. Drake's a demon. He's evil.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but yeah.
And you know they're reporting that Drake is trying to slide into those DMs for Kim Kardashian right now. Oh, well, he has a number, I'm sure, but
he's a demon. But I can't wait till they tell that full story. But it's only four people that can tell that story fully, though. It would have to be Meek, Drake, Drama, and Quentin Miller.
You don't think Lake Sheezy and Don Cannon either?
Nah, those four in particular, specifically, would have to be the ones to tell that full story.
And listen, I got to slide this one in here, too, since you guys were talking about mixtapes and Versus is coming up this weekend. There was some random podcast.
Oh, hell no.
That,
who's that voice? Go ahead, continue.
And listen to this. Potentially, I guess DJ Drama was talking about perhaps a Versus battle.
Would you be down to do it if you got tapped?
I'm going to say this. Like, when it comes to mixtape catalog, and there's a lot of legends out here,
yep.
Pay my respect to everybody that came before me and then came after me. Nobody wants to see me.
Wow.
To mixtape catalog. I guarantee it. They can talk all they want. Yep. Nobody's fucking with me when it comes to mixtape catalog. If we're just talking about shit off the mixtapes,
yeah,
I will murder anybody.
Wow, that's a bold. You have no fear whatsoever. Anybody,
man, give me all the smoke.
Some people are throwing out Clue might be a good match for you,
man. Clue is I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Clue.
Mm-hmm.
Clue is like the OG, you know what I'm saying? If he's Dr. J, I'm Jordan, or if he's Jordan, I'm Kobe. But nobody wants smoke with my catalog, bro.
Man, salute the Drama for being so humble to give that to a fan. You know what I'm saying?
Y'all talking so disrespectful.
To be randomly talking to a fan and just tell a fan, you know, something like that. Yeah, I thought
Drama said he was leaving the station and there was a guy outside with a recorder
up,
and he just felt bad for him. So.
That was my damn show. You guys can show some respect.
That was you outside with the recorder.
Oh, you know what? Yeah. Drama was saying something like somebody tried to steal his name and then people were mistaking this other person.
Okay. I played that clip because essentially I wanted you guys, we're taking some modern day examples. Kanye West. All right, let's name some other people. And once again, we're looking at wealth without regulation, particularly government regulation, the years 1607 to 1776. What can we learn from how people accumulated great wealth then? How can we take a look at those fundamental distinctions and principles and apply them to what we're doing right now in 2021 and beyond? Okay, we established the fact that these people got into something that had little or completely zero regulation. All right. I'm using black examples and white examples, but Anthony Johnson, my prime one, in colonial times, the agencies that you have today didn't exist back then. including there was no state law. He was in the Virginia colony, but it wasn't Virginia as a state. So there was no state law. There was no federal law. So a lot of things that there was no FDA, Food and Drug Administration. There was no Department of Agriculture. All these government agencies that we have today, to a very high degree, impede your attempts to get wealthy. I played, Kanye West. All right, what did Kanye West do, or what is he doing that the framers of the Constitution did, and as well as Anthony Johnson? And you heard Angela Yee broke down some of the industries that he was in. Well, right off the top in plain sight, hip-hop, no matter what you think about the culture or the music, hip-hop is not regulated. You don't need a business license to start a hip-hop company. He makes his money in clothing. And you know what? We may as well throw Dr. Dre in this too, because Dr. Dre is worth $1 billion also. Now, these two guys have become billionaires in an emerging market. Hip-hop is an emerging market on a global basis. You got German hip-hoppers. You got Russian hip-hoppers. You got Japanese hip-hoppers. It's totally not a part of the old boy network at all, because the old boy network is regulated, heavily government regulated. And then when we can't get in, we cry racism. No, we need to take a look at the blueprint from 1607 to 1776. What lessons or distinctions can we note from then and apply them to right now? Once again, Dr. Hip-hop is an emerging industry that has zero regulation. That's how Kanye West, no matter what you think about him, is a multi-billionaire now, because hip-hop is not regulated. Dr. Dre did a deal that made him a billionaire with headphones. He doesn't even manufacture the headphones. It's a private label. Beats, what's it called? Beats? It's a private label. Anyone that's hearing my voice right now can get on Alibaba right now, locate a manufacturing company, a factory company. That's why I play Factory City. Because we also had to think about, and you notice none of these guys are talking about, I want my reparations. Hip-hop is an industry born right here in the United States of America. We can trace it all the way to Brooklyn, New York, throwing all five boroughs of New York. That's us. So, let's see, Kanye West, Puff Daddy, Berry Gordy, because when Berry Gordy started Motown Records in Detroit, and if you haven't read his book, the memoir he wrote, I suggest getting it, where his wife didn't believe in him. He was disrespected. He was working on a factory. Motown, selling culture. Because that's what Motown is. He was selling black culture, rhythm and blues. You know what? Let me break it down even more definite. The common denominator between Kanye West, Berry Gordy, the framers of the Constitution, Anthony Johnson, is intellectual property. An idea. You don't need to have a business license to act on an idea. Berry Gordy between him and John H. Johnson, they were the first two black folk, black Americans, to be on the Forbes 400. And I suggest buying the book, Succeeding Against the Odds, written by John H. Johnson. When that book first came out, I bought 8 copies of that book, gave away 7 of them. Classic book. Started with the Negro Digest, then morphed into Ebony and Jet. To produce a magazine zero regulation. Now, at the time he was doing it, because he was using paper, there was some regulation dealing with the paper and all that. But now, hell, you can do it with Huffington Post. You can go digital with a magazine or a newspaper now. Zero regulation. These are black folks. Master P, intellectual property. That's the common denominator with a lot of these people I'm naming, intellectual property. Let's hit another clip.
Today we have organizations like the SBA making it easier for you to get into business. But 50 years ago, what do you think the odds would be that you could start your own small business and make it succeed?
The odds were against a black man succeeding in the business world, but John Johnson has never been one to look at the downside. He used $500, perseverance, faith, and family devotion to build an empire worth nearly $200 million. His name is now a legend in the world of publishing, fashion, beauty products, and broadcasting. John Johnson has a formula for taking what seems impossible and making it real. His story is an inspiration for people of all colors.
Well, I guess it just proves in a continuing way that there is opportunity there, that given the knowledge, the devotion, and the sacrifice, that success can come. So it ought to tell us that more young blacks ought to take a chance. I think, really, that in the past, when young blacks have gone to college, we have assumed that we did not get respect and prestige unless we went into the professions. I think now more and more that is changing. We're recognizing that money and success gives you prestige and recognition, even though it may come from selling hamburgers, it may come from selling barbecue, it may come from opening a grocery store or running a cleaning plant or any other thing. And I think as we move ahead and as those areas, the business area, gets more recognition and more credibility, then I think more young people will go into it. Unfortunately, in the white corporate world as we know it today, there is a ceiling on how far blacks can go. There are rare exceptions, but by and large, the vice presidency is as far as you can go. Now, there are some of us who are not just temperamentally suited to be only vice president. We want to be presidents. We want to run things. We want to be in charge. For those people, I say, you've got to go out and start your own. And so I believe for people who are satisfied to be a vice president, perhaps in the long run, for people who want to work for someone else and to live under the fear now of mergers and buyouts, all of which jeopardize their security. If they want to live that way, fine. But if they really want to have a degree of security, a degree of fulfillment, if they want to make a contribution to the race as a whole, then I think they need to go out and start their own.
If you had to do it all over again today, what type of business would you go into?
If I was starting over again today and if all the publications were in place that are in place today, I don't think I'd go into the publishing business. I think I'd be inclined to go into the service business, somewhere where you're rendering service. I might want to start my own chain of hamburger places. I still think it's very sad that we don't have barbecue franchises. I think we could develop cleaning establishment franchises. I think anything that would give service to the public would be a good thing to go into now. Because service is no longer important to people. You walk around and people are arrogant. They're insensitive. They don't want to serve. So I'd want to be in something where service would move me ahead.
What advice would you give a small business going after a larger client?
And I developed a simple philosophy. I said that I would call companies and they all wanted to refer me to the contributions department. And I say, no, I don't want a contribution. I want to give you something in return for your giving me something. I would always say that if the president of the smallest country in the world came to America, our president, as a matter of public policy and protocol, would see that president. And I said to the people, I am the president of a very small company, but I am the president. And I feel that as a matter of courtesy, your president ought to see me. Now, I have to say I was never turned down. I was put aside. I was delayed. But I was never turned down. And persistence went out. I think what you need more than anything else in going into business is persistence, a refusal to give up, a motivation to continue when everything looks like you ought to quit. And I think that's what entrepreneurs have to have.
How important is access to information to the small business person?
There's a great need for information. There are all kinds of people out there who are writing me letters and calling up with good ideas and wanting to know how to go into business. So I think if we had a national television show devoted to business development, it would be a great thing.
All right, that was the late John H. Johnson, and he was in a business. Well, actually, he essentially invented a market or even industry, because there were other black magazine followers that have followed him even to this day. Now we're going to play one last clip, we're looking at Wealth Without Regulation, the year 1607 to 1776. Kanye West, once again, hip-hop isn't regulated. Puff Daddy, he's a hip-hop mogul too. It's not regulated. Berry Gordy, rhythm and blues, intellectual property, is not regulated. Oh, well, you know what? There's a little regulation with copyrights, because all the stuff that came out of Motown had a copyright. So, but it, basically, little regulation there. Master P, intellectual property, very copyright regulation, but that's about it. Russell Simmons, once again, intellectual property, other than copyrights or an occasional trademark, you know, when was the last time you heard of somebody going to jail over a copyright? They might get fined or whatever, or told not to do something, but it's easy to get into. John H. Johnson, who we just heard from, basically invented a market, the distribution points or the system. I highly recommend this book. Succeeding Against the Odds. Like I said, when he first released it, I bought 8 copies, gave 7 of them away. And an industry which is still wide open. It's still wide open, providing information specifically to African Americans. Now, we have another Kanye clip, and then we're going to go to the phone lines.
I don't think people necessarily understand what happened last week with the Make America Great Again hat. What are you trying to do with the message you're sending?
Well, it was really just my subconscious. It was a feeling I had. You know, like, people were taught how to think. We're taught how to feel. We don't know how to think for ourselves. We don't know how to feel for ourselves. People say feel free, but they don't really want us to feel free. And I felt a freedom. And first of all, just doing something that everybody tells you not to do. I just love Trump. That's my boy. Like, you know, it's like so many rappers. You'll look at a video of Snoop Dogg loving Trump, but then he get in the office and now they don't love him. Like, Trump is one of rap's favorite people,
no,
right?
But we talk about this, that before he was elected president, people in hip-hop, it was an in thing to put Donald Trump in your rhyme somewhere.
Yeah. And by the way, I am in hip-hop, but I'm not just in hip-hop. I'm a black person in a black community, but I'm not just that. I feel like one thing is people try to minimize me to artists, hip-hop, black community. Yeah, I'm always going to represent that, but also represent the world. When you hear about slavery for 400 years, for 400 years, that sounds like a choice. Like, you was there for 400 years and it's all of y'all? You know, like, it's like we're mentally in prison. I like the word prison because slavery goes too direct to the idea of blacks. It's like slavery, Holocaust Jews, slavery is blacks. So prison is something that unites us as one race, blacks and whites being one race, that we're one, we're the human race. Do you feel that I'm feeling, do you feel that I'm being free and I'm thinking free?
I actually don't think you're thinking anything. I think what you're doing right now is actually the absence of thought. And the reason why I feel like that
is because Kanye, you're entitled to your opinion. You're entitled to believe whatever you want. But there is fact and real world, real life consequence behind everything that you just said. And while you are making music and being an artist and living the life that you've earned by being a genius, the rest of us in society have to deal with these threats to our lives. We have to deal with the marginalization that has come from the 400 years of slavery that you said for our people was a choice. Frankly, I'm disappointed, I'm appalled, and brother, I am unbelievably hurt by the fact that you have morphed into something, to me, that's not real. Bro, you gotta be responsible, man.
Bro, I'm sorry
you
I hurt you.
You gotta be responsible.
No. I'm sorry I hurt you, bro.
Bro, your voice is too big. You got.
We can do a whole podcast on that last one. But Kanye, no matter what you think about him, he got hit. Now, firstly, you're not hearing him going after reparations. He doesn't count the white man's money. He doesn't count his ancestors' money from 300 or 400 years or whatever number you want to pick out of here. But what he did, I don't know if he did it consciously, once again, tying into today's title of this podcast, Wealth Without Regulations, years 1607 to 1776, specifically July 3rd, 1776. Conrad did the same thing as, Kanye did the same thing as Ben Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, and Anthony Johnson, who happened to be black. He got into something that had little or 0% government regulation. Kanye West, and look, the exchange between the two, particularly the guy who said Kanye deeply hurt him. Kanye is a hip hopper, and he got that. Man, how old is Kanye West? Kanye got involved in the opportunities of hip hop because, once again, you can't go and get a degree. There's no hip hop degree offered at Yale or any college or university on the planet. When the framers of the Constitution, before they signed that Declaration of Independence, there was no school, there was no university degree on how to become a planner. There were no government regular. There's no United States Department of Hip Hop. Hip Hop is still unregulated. Other than, oh, hold it, now let's rein in just a teeny bit. Maybe for copyright, the intellectual property aspects of it, intellectual property in the form of trademarks and copyrights. But other than that, hip-hop is unregulated. You can gain massive amounts of wealth. And you don't even have to be a rapper. Part of his portfolio is clothing. You know? He's not counting anybody else's money. That's where, and I don't know what the, I don't know what percentage of African Americans want reparations. And I don't even know if it's on a critical mass basis, you know, if we want it. All I'm saying is, because what you're doing is you got to get into the accounting, you know, the history, you know. And the wild thing about it is you got some black, God bless them now, that are testifying behind Congress. And then I think they might have, well, you know, well, let's get a study out on reparations, you know, through Congress or whatever. And it's going to take an act of Congress for that all that stuff to happen. While the critical mass of people that want reparations, people like Kanye, Dr. Dre, Puff Daddy, Russell Simmons, that are making a killing because there's virtually little or no competition in hip-hop, because hip-hop is an emerging global industry. That's something that black folks got. That's what I call reparations. We're going to open up the phone lines here in a moment. So the 60-second lady and all that, we've been going past there for all year anyway. But in any event, that's what we need to look at. And that's why I recommend check out between 1607 and 1776. The majority of the examples I gave today, starting with Anthony Johnson. Anthony Johnson, a black man who lived during colonial times, the common denominator between him, Steve Jobs, Wozniak, Bill Gates, throw Jeff Bezos in there, and Kanye West, Eazy-E, the late Eazy-E, he's making money from the grave. Why? Because he got involved and he created generational wealth via intellectual property in under the hip-hop emerging market industry. Now, here's the good thing about it. There are other emerging market industries that anybody, including black folks, can get involved in and make their billions too. The average person that's listening to this podcast right now is probably smarter than Kanye West. Smarter than Kanye. The guy who said Kanye hurt him . That's a slave to me. If you're listening, whoever your name is, that's why I recommend go check out what was happening in the entire Western Hemisphere. But listen, they was on what we now call the United States between 1607 and 1776, and then once again, those people got fabulously wealthy because they were not in a highly regulated, or in most cases, there was zero regulation. So people might be saying, well, you know, that was back then, but what about now? That's why I brought up the Kanye's, the Master P, the Eazy-E's, the John H. Johnson. We can go out Dudley Products. Dudley Products, their niche is black hair care. Their niche within the niche is they sell to, the first thing, they make shampoos and conditioners and all these cosmetics. And their niche within that niche of black hair care is they go to black hair salons as their distribution outlet, their retail outlet. And he's created generational wealth for his family. Joe Louis Dudley and his wife. Now his kids run it. They got an outlet in Zimbabwe and one in Brazil as well. Because people are talking about, you know, well, all these companies are going over to, you know, China or to India or whatever, and they're using slaves. Call it what you want. I call it affordable labor. But you know what? That's why I look about Dudley Products. They're over in Zimbabwe. In Zimbabwe, matter of fact, let's look at the currency exchange. Zimbabwe. Okay, the Zimbabwe. Okay, the United States dollar. Oh, hold it. I want to get this straight. One American dollar multiplies into 361 Zimbabwean dollars. In Zimbabwe, labor is incredibly less expensive than American labor. More power to the Dudleys. I haven't heard anything about him and the Dudley family and the Dudley community wanting to get their reparations. Of course, when he started his own business, he and his wife, that's a form of reparations. He also has a company in Brazil, a branch in Brazil, and the Brazilian currency is multiplies by four or five times. Might be five times now. Let me look it up real quick. Right, the Zimbabwean dollar multiplies by 361. So what's happening in Brazil right now? Because Dudley is there. And you know, once again, black hair care is still emerging. All right, the dollar multiplies by right now is in real time by five. It multiplies by $5.50. It multiplies by five in Brazil. $200,000 in American money, you're a millionaire in Brazil. But Dudley, he went, once again, opened up in Zimbabwe and got a outfit in, what do you call it, Brazil. There is some regulation, but it's less regulation in those places than it is here. And then even over here, all right, the hair care industry, beauty supply shops, there's some regulation, but it's light. It's not strangled. You know, their video clips of people, and tomorrow, let me announce it right now. Tomorrow we have a special guest calling in. We're going to do another update on Amish economics. We're going to take a look at the Amish and how we can apply what they do without becoming an Amish person. What do they do that we can also mirror in our daily lives? But anyway, that's tomorrow. But anyway, you know what? Let me shut up. I done rambled on. Let's go to the phone lines. 410, your mic is open. 410, mic is open. You might have yourself on mute. Okay, going once, going twice. All right, well.
Hello?
I'm going to leave. Yeah. Oh, okay.
Hello?
Yes, sir. We can hear you.
I had you on mute.
Okay, no problem.
Hotep, how you doing, brother?
I'm doing fine.
I've been looking at your past podcast, and I just want to I don't mean to sound like a broke record, but you always pick out subjects that stimulate thought. And I got to give it to you. Your podcasts really get people to thinking. And sometimes it pisses people off like myself. But anyway, you know.
That's what it does.
Yeah, and sometimes it makes me happy. But, you know, I mean, you stir the emotions. Look. Through all of your, you know, conversation here, that's why it upsets me to no end when you have some black folks say black folks have never done anything or never made anything and basically call African descendants of slaves riffraff. You know, I mean, it bugs me to no end because, look, you just mentioned intellectual property, didn't you?
Right.
Wasn't hip-hop intellectual property?
Yeah, no doubt about it.
Isn't hip-hop one of the chief exports of Americans?
Absolutely right. I mean, the first time I was over in Germany, first trip, and I met this young lady. She was a teenager at the time. And I asked, you know, what is she like? And the first thing out of her mouth was hip-hop.
Exactly. And look, didn't it spawn out of the black hood or the black ghetto?
Yes, it did.
The place where everybody comes down on black folks. Isn't that where the birth of hip-hop came out of?
No question about it.
So, you know,
you can't
that's
deny
why,
it.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, you can't deny it. Hip hop came. That's us. That's black folk.
And let me go a step further. Jazz, rock and roll, soul, country western, all of that came out of the genius of black folks. And the thing is, you have these idiots that come up there and say, "Well, black folks have never done anything. You know, they've never made anything." And look. The whole world copies after black culture. Now, I'm getting to a point here. That's why we need to go in and we need to make sure that we organize around an identity. See, because everybody's getting rich off black culture. Everybody's getting rich off of black intellectual genius. And the thing is, once we deny who we are, and we have these questions about our color and who we are, then what happens is you have everybody coming in and chipping off. Now, look, I'm going to give you this. The record companies in the entertainment industry, the Big Five, I guess mm-hmm. that's what they're called, would never survive without hip-hop. But because we didn't have an identity, we didn't see the importance or the need or the benefits of going in and investing in controlling that culture, that hip hop culture. I mean, if you look around, the entertainment world does not benefit from rock. If you turn on the TV, you very rarely hear a hard rock song. As a background to commercial.
Well, you know, it's interesting you said that because Gene Simmons from the group Kiss, he said it a couple of times. He says that rock, you know, the headbanging rock, is dead. But if you look at hip hop, I mean, you see rappers in TV shows, movies, and that's all part of that hip hop industry.
And it's steady evolving. And it's steady evolving.
Right. That's why I say hip-hop is an emerging industry. It's still, like you said, it's evolving.
Yeah, but because we idiots, ADOS, or either people that criticize ADOS, we deny our color and we deny the need to go in and organize around our race. And the thing is, because we don't organize around our race, we don't go in and accumulate enough money aggregate in an aggregated form to go in and invest in who we are. Now, I want to get to this.
So, Beasley, I think part of the reason for that is, and I mean, what your thoughts on it is, I think part of the reason for that is the black church has lamb, except for maybe somebody like Kirk Franklin, the black church, you know, the climbing up the rough side of the mountain gospel folk, they have bad-mouthed hip-hop.
And look, nobody has bad-mouthed hip-hop more than a black conservative. Let's be real. If you look at it, they use black conservatives to lambast the rappers. You know, I look at Fox News. When Bill O'Reilly was at his height, every evening he had something bad to say about hip-hop. Now, and look, I bet you can go back and look at some of your conservative friends talking about hip-hop, about how degenerate it was, you know, how beastly it was. But, you know, the thing is this. See, we are our own worst enemies, L.A. We get up here and we hate what white folks hate and we love what white folks love because they have trained us to be white folks with black skin. And because of that, they can come in and pick and choose out of our culture what they want to because, look, because Jive Records, Universal, Disney, all of those companies are thriving off of hip-hop. Now, you can't deny that, but because we can't get together, and look, let me give you this year. Gospel selling like crazy. I don't know whether you know it or not, but I made a living off of selling gospel, and you got gospel rap. And the thing is, you can't go in and deny that old Sally Mae don't love her gospel. But now the church has some problems in that too because we've been trained to be white. And the thing is, when the white man says something is bad, we come in and regurgitate that same foolishness. When they say it's good, then all of a sudden, hey, it's good. Because, look, white folks say rap is good now because they're making plenty of money on it. All because we hate our identity. They have trained us to do that. And I'm going to give you this. I have a calendar, and if I can ever get your address, I'll send it to you, of the black folks that have made major accomplishments in Silicon Valley. You don't hear about it because they don't publicize that. But Silicon Valley wouldn't be Silicon Valley without black inventors. And you know what? I'll bet anybody listening to this to bet me on it. Because when I say something, Brother Ellie, you know I can back my stuff up. And I'm going to give you this. I told you the other day that a big portion of the major industries came from black inventions, black inventors' intellectual know-how. Yeah. And the thing is, they're billion-dollar businesses. Now, they've made trillions of dollars of black genius. And, I'm going to end on this year because I always like to hit you on this year. I bring the conversational reparations up just like Jews bring up Holocaust because I don't want our next generation to know or forget what got us into this mess of slavery. And we may not get reparations, but the conversation has to be out here all the time in the airways because, look, if you ignore history, you're doomed to repeat it. And if we don't keep that conversation going and to let our young folks know about the horrors of slavery, then they'll fall right back in it. And you can see that now. I mean, when you have Raheem that disinterested in going to school and getting a good education, all of that is because they're not aware of what happened to black men back during slavery. See, back during slavery, it was against the law to read and write. We need to let them know that, hey, the reason why come you have that privilege now is because of the efforts and the blood and sweat and tears of our ancestors. If you don't let them know, hey, the reason why come you have different shades of black folk is because the raping of our women and the brutalization of our men, hangings and castrations and everything else. So now, yeah, we can do all of the things you're talking about, and we're successful. But the trick is, if we just dwell on what we're doing today and we don't let our young folks, the next generation, know about what happened in the past, then they'll know how the hell we got here. So, yeah, I'm going to keep reparations going, and, yeah, I'm going to support the fight for it. But the thing is, the day that you tell me that Jews need to shut up about the Holocaust, then you can tell me to shut the hell up about slavery and reparations. You get me?
Fair enough.
You get me?
Fair enough.
Okay. Guess what?
And
you're
right on the history thing, because I went back in history today. I said, let's look at it from 1607 to 1776. So, yeah, you need to know the history.
Oh, and
you
look.
Need to know the history.
Here's the thing. I'm going to give you this here, and I want my boy to chip in on this. The main reason why the United States is an economic force on the planet is because of the slavery and the profits they made off our backs while we were bent over picking cotton, raising rice, growing corn, and everything else. Because, look, before we got over here, those monkeys didn't know what the hell to do. If you look at the history of Europe, they were starving to death before they got over here. And they didn't know a whole hell of a lot about farming. And the other thing is, before the Moors got over there, which was black, because I know a lot of colored folk, well, the Moors were white. No, hell no, they were black. They were Africans. The Moors had to go over there and civilize those savages and teach them how to bathe and shave and every damn thing else. So now, you know, when you hear some clowns up there talking about, well, black folks didn't do nothing in Africa and didn't they do anything over here, that's because they don't know history. And that's why I come out they intercourse the neck every time I get a chance. So I get off and let somebody else talk.
Okay. Now, one thing you said you've made plenty of money with black gospel.
Plenty of money with black gospel, black exploitation movies, black literature. I used to sell all of that stuff. I had two stores in North Carolina. I moved one up to Baltimore, and I used to set up at the Pasco Flea Market. I don't know if you're familiar with that flea market or not.
I've heard of it, but that's the one I never went to that one. I haven't gone there yet.
Well, the thing is, 30,000 black folk used to go in there every Saturday and Sunday. That guy that ran Patapsco Flea Market made $30,000 in just charging a quarter admission. And guess who 98% of the people were that went in there to buy stuff?
It was Baltimore.
Us. And that's why getting people to identify with their identity and getting people to support and organize our identity is so important. Now, you can come up with this stuff with who's black and how do you determine black. God dang it, you can do it, and you can do it with codification and every darn thing else. But the thing is, in one Saturday, I made more at Patapsco Market than I made in 2 months in North Carolina in a rural area.
All right. Now, a flea market, there's very little regulation, because that's what I went back in the time machine on that. All right, let me get it before we run out of time. 314, your mic is open.
What do you say, L.A.?
How's it going?
You know, I'm going to tell you now, when people talk to you and be running off, you got to pay attention to what they say. Because talking about that place, the charge 25 cents for a person to come in, and he said 30,000 people come in. Well, that's a lie. Because he made $30,000, and he charged a quarter to come in. That's 120,000 people. And if you do the math on entering and going in and coming out, that's literally impossible to do in an 8-hour day. In most places, because of the fire code in the raggedy places, what was, they don't allow that many people in a place. And you said something else. So you listened to hip-hop. You ran into hip-hop when you was where, overseas?
In Germany. They got German hip-hoppers. Yeah.
And where else? Say Japan and that?
Here's
Japan, the thing.
South Korea, Africa. Okay. I mean, they got hip-hoppers all over the place.
All right. All right. So if American hip-hoppers began something, how are they going to control it in those other countries? What language was you listening to hip-hop in North Korea, South Korea and in Germany? They were singing it in Germany. So how in the heck is a black hip-hopper going to go over into Germany? I mean, I don't understand how you – they control their own stuff. Here in parts of China, along the Silk Road, and I can't think, I think it's Jianjin, they have karaoke night. They sing it in their own language. Can you imagine Kanye West singing in Chinese language or in German? It ain't going to work. These people come up with all these old crazy assertions. They're completely out of their dang dough, man, I think. Slaves ain't – you know, I tell you something that blacks did, since people want to say that all black skin is skin, they taught the world how to do slavery. Because they was doing it thousands of years before anyone from Asia, Western Asia, who you call Europe today, or Spain, came in contact with them. Matter of fact, when they came in contact, they wasn't looking for no human beings. That's a dag don't make no sense. But, you know, you're talking about things to do. There's a lot of things to do. It is that is what is that what is it that you want to do? Or what do somebody need? If it was me, I'd be getting involved in the mining, the extraction and processing of minerals, even look at mining asteroids. Have you ever thought about that?
No. You put a whole new... I never even heard of that.
Yeah, that would be a great...
Are you talking about like a shooting star? Because I've seen a few of those. And wherever they land is... Okay. I never thought about that.
Absolutely. All you got to do is get the stuff
back to Earth. Now, why mine those? I'm assuming they have variable minerals within those asteroids.
Yeah, they got heavy metal minerals and rare earth minerals. Propulsions would be another. Now, that's a great need for cyber engineer, cyber protection, cyber security engineer. I think there's about a shortage of about over a million in that particular field. And that's what the young people should be getting involved in. Or they may want to be getting involved in entertainment, providing fun, laughter, either bouncing the ball, running the ball, shooting the ball, or having a ball. Running the ball, shooting the ball, bouncing the ball, or having a ball.
Let me ask you, you mentioned entertainment. Now, we got plenty, I'm sort of like restricted to the United States. We got plenty of... you know, Michael Jackson's, all these singing groups. You got athletes, you know, LeBron James, you know, football players. All, you know, we know all the pro athletes and all that, and entertainers now as well as historic ones like that. Now, what about, and the closest one I know, well, I don't know, I wouldn't even call that close. What about building entertainment facilities, like building theaters or building like, you know, that stadium you built, building stadiums where people can have various events?
Well, stadiums, as far as movie theaters, people look at stuff on their telephones nowadays. And then you get into some areas I don't know much about. I can't tell you about no theater. I don't know much. I don't know much about theater.
Well, like, you know, if you built the stadium before, okay, you built the stadium, and in those stadiums, you know, people have had concerts in those stadiums. sporting events in those
boat
stadiums.
Shows, auto shows. Yeah,
right.
They have
so
those things. That's what you call expo space.
Yeah, see, that, all right, here's how I look at sports right now. Instead of trying to be a LeBron James or a football player and all this, why not get into the aspect, because I consider building a stadium or an arena, that's the aspect of the business
it comes down
that
with
you
the
don't
finance.
Hear anybody
People.
Talk about.
Well, it gets down to the finance, and you're talking about LeBron James. You got to mention Larry Bird, too. You got to mention Pistol Pete Maverick also. Although they was white, they were some bad boys. I think Larry Bird's a better basketball player than LeBron James, depending on the style. But when you're talking about building something, a stadium, you're talking about having to utilize public finance and a lot of wrangling so that you don't get trapped into deals. We built this, those stadiums I built in St. Louis. At the time, it's called a TWA Dome, and it went on to be called the Edwards Dome because of the stock securities trader.
Mm-hmm.
It's not used for either one of those today. They may have... You know, the Rams left. The Rams went out to Los Angeles after their contract for occupancy left because of the market. It's downtown St. Louis. People in the areas are not coming down there because of the crime. Same thing in Atlanta. Look at Atlanta. The Atlanta Braves left the city and went out into the suburbs because the people that got the money that come to the events don't come down there because of the crime.
Doesn't St. Louis have a baseball team?
St. Louis just built a new baseball stadium.
Okay.
You had another company in St. Louis, Centene, C-E-N-T-E-N-N-E. They was going to build a $2 billion expansion. And the owner's wife, she made some comments about the Metrolink, which is light rail transportation, and the crime is so bad on it by blacks that, you know, just lurk on people, that they're building that $2 billion expansion in South Carolina the last time that I talked about it, some suburb in South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well,
so that's the thing, that's the problem you have with. See, you got to have customers for these things that people be dreaming of.
Well, and that's folks, true.
Now, blacks are making ways. And, you know, as blacks increase their economic prosperity, their political wranglings are going to change. They're going to become more conservative in their thinking because when you lay it out on the table, and you need to have a podcast on that. What's the difference? Who offers the benefits? So when you come down to the education, you come down to the economics, a conservative way of going, capitalism, you got these idiots talking about
James
capitalism is bad.
James Brown was Republican.
Was Republican.
Sammy Davis Jr. was Republican. Kathy Hughes, who's delivering now with Radio 1, she's Republican. The late
You look at those that's on Black Enterprise Top 100, if they're not, they're crazy because the difference in taxation on your business, if you're doing a business that's publicly traded, you're supposed to be doing it for the fiduciary benefit of those that's involved in you.
True. Yeah, most
paying less
on that list are Republican,
Yeah,
that's
so
true.
That's the way, that's what I try to instill in the people that I talk to. And really, you don't have to talk to them. All you just got to do is lay it out in front of them. You know, like the guy was arguing with Kanye West.
Mm-hmm.
Kanye West told the truth when he said it was a choice. It actually was a choice. When you use logical thinking, you know why it was a choice? It was a choice because the people that was indulged in it and helped make it happen chose to do that. Because it was the nature of the day. It was a practice. It was an industry. As I said before, Portuguese didn't come down the West African coast looking for human beings. They were propositioned in providing transportation.
Mm-hmm.
Those that was here in this country needed labor. Needed
right.
labor and clearing
they
land.
Needed affordable
in agriculture. Absolutely. And any idiot, you know, you guys, have you guys, you said your mother left a lot of stuff when she died, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She accumulated a lot of stuff, right?
Yeah, she did.
Did your mother ever get rid of some stuff, too?
Oh, yeah, over the years she got rid of some stuff.
All right, now let me give you an example. She got rid of the stuff she didn't want, and she kept the stuff she wanted to keep that was valuable.
Right.
That's the same
Correct.
Way they was doing with human beings. If you ain't no good for nothing, like many of them that you hear today, they get rid of you. Let me ask you another thing. You in a community. You commit a crime. You go to court, and they sentence you to go to jail. What did I just say? Go to jail. That means they getting you out of their midst where you can commit
right.
more. They don't need you. They get rid of you. What did Britain do with its criminals? They got what? Rid of them. Sent
they
them where?
Them out. They
to what
Trump
country
came
today?
Over here. The
Australia.
State of Georgia used to be a the state of Georgia was a penal colony at one time for Britain, England rather. And so was Australia.
So I wonder who they learned it from, L.A. Who's been doing that kind of thing for the longest in the history of man?
Well,
it was Africans. A human being.
Out of Africa.
They had a right to do it. They sent them east to the Arabs. And right there on the coast where the agents from other countries was set up. You ever seen, you know they have trade fairs, right?
Yeah.
They have a trade fair in Las Vegas dealing with clothing. Okay. You have Asian manufacturers come in, put stuff on display. Okay. People that's working for companies like Walmart or Target, they send their what? Agents to that trade fair and negotiate on what it is that they want. Well, that's the same
buyer.
Way they done with the slave trade. They sent their agents. Buyers are agents. Mm-hmm. They sent their, you had agents here that sent their buyers who set up warehousing there on the West Coast. Today we call them what? Forts. Actually, it wasn't forts. It was people because the forts was really used initially to store the goods that they was buying. But then they started using to store people because people then was what? It was commodities. It was goods. So the agents went there. They stored the people. You know, nobody's going to bring a 300 down at one time. They bring two, three, a dozen, two dozen down at one time. They store them. The ships come, they put them on the ships, they send them to the buyers over here. And then they have the auctions. That's the way they do today with surplus, what you call cars, the old cars. They have car auctions.
In every city.
Over there in Togo.
Major city. Yeah.
Over there in Togo, I used to go down to the markets, or should it, to the port. Man, you see some of the biggest ships you ever want to see. Come in and dock, and they call ro-ros, roll on, roll off. And they would roll off those ships, I would say at least 5,000 cars. Roll them off, they store them there, and then buyers come in and buy what they want, used car buyers. So that's the way it happened with tangible things. That's the way it was going on with people, too. And if you don't believe, you can go some places today and see it. So that's just it. Now, if you ever want to get involved in something, because I don't tell everything for decrepit ears. If you want to get involved in some things, I can tell you some things that you can get involved in. And I can't do it because I don't have time to do it. I'm beyond the age of wanting to get involved in those type of ventures. But there's a lot of stuff involved that you can get involved in Liberia. I know one area called the River G-E-E, where you can have access to over 750 square miles. You know what 750 square miles looks? That'd be like coming from Louisiana, going up to Kansas City, Missouri. Louisiana border with Mississippi, going to Kansas City, Missouri. Make a right, go that far again. Make another right, go that far again. Make another right, go that far again. Make another right and come back where you started. That's 750 square miles. And you have everything in there from cocoa, virgin timber, even fresh water that you can develop.
Mm.
And slaves, the Africans that brought here, did not build the United States. They came here, and even when you're planting, they was introduced to plows, steel plows here. They didn't have no steel mm-hmm. plows in Africa. They didn't need it. They were using stone tools. Who are they going to get steel from? I ain't talking about iron. I said steel. Anyway, man, that's about all I can tell you.
All right. Well, thanks for the feedback. I'll be in touch with you. On that note, we'll see you guys tomorrow. Everybody have a good rest of the day.